You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Who's here in the room? Thank you. As well as with the Brazil Human Rights Fund, Deputy Director Myra is here and Pedro as well. We have been supporting groups in Brazil that are looking at the criminal justice system and state sponsored violence from a perspective of racial disparities and racial discrimination for the past about 3 years now. It's an ongoing collaboration with the Brazil Fund that is able to be on the ground and help us identify good partners and help us think through strategy. And we wanted to take the opportunity to bring those activists to the U.S. during this very auspicious week of the Smart on Crime Conference and the Drug Policy Alliance Conference in Atlanta, where we're headed next, to really get a chance to be in dialogue with activists on the U.S. side who are facing similar issues around police violence, mass incarceration, and the drug war. So it's really an opportunity to learn a little bit about the Brazilian context and to hear about some of their struggles and to compare, share notes with our U.S. colleagues and activists, build a little solidarity, see where the commonalities are, and how we take a strategy forward. So I invite you to be ready with questions, and I will let Jasmine finish the introductions.
Thank you. All right, good afternoon. Thank you all for joining us today for this really critical conversation on policing Black bodies. It's my honor to present to you our panelists today, activists within the U.S. and in Brazil. So I'm just going to ask that each person introduce yourself with a one or two sentence summary of the work you do in its relationship to policing and mass incarceration.
Good. Good evening, everyone. How you feeling? My name is Marlon Peterson. I'm Brooklyn native. I always throw that out there by way of Trinidad, West Indies. The work that I do has revolved over the last couple of years around the intersections of police violence, but also gun violence prevention.
Boa tarde a todas e todos. Eu sou Wagner Moreira. Sou do IDEA da Assessoria Popular e trabalho com advocacy envolvendo questões territoriais de desenvolvimento e questões raciais.
Questões o quê?
Raciais.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Wagner Campos e eu trabalho and I work with the movement IDEA. Assessoria Popular, and I work with advocacy, I work with territorial issues, and the last one was?
Racial discrimination.
And racial discrimination issues. Good afternoon.
Boa tarde, eu sou Francisca Sena, brasileira, moro no Ceará e participo de uma organização de mulheres negras chamado Instituto Negra do Ceará.
My name is Francisca Sena. I am Brazilian from the state of Ceará, and I work with a group of Brazilian Black females. And the organization is called Institute of Black Brazilian Women of the State of Ceará.
Desenvolvemos vários trabalhos, mas vamos destacar aqui hoje nossa experiência no presídio feminino do estado do Ceará e o trabalho desenvolvido com aquelas mulheres, com as egressas e aquelas que estão fora do presídio, mas esperando o resultado do processo.
I work on various different aspects, but here I'm going to speak about my work in the Ceará, state of Ceará incarceration system. And how we develop and the work that we do with women who are incarcerated and women who are also recidivists and women who are outside incarceration and waiting for a resolution to their cases.
Good evening. I'm Jennifer Shaw. I'm a program officer here at Open Society Foundation, and I work in the U.S. programs on the the justice team. My portfolio focuses on police reform and death penalty, so most relevant tonight is the police reform work that I'm working on. I'm really excited to hear what my colleagues from Brazil have to say today, too.
Excellent. Thank you. So I guess when we think about our current state of policing and the recent movements that have emerged as a result of police violence in the U.S., it's really important for us to think about the roots of policing. Where did the current system of policing begin? And it really starts with the early dehumanization, commodification, and criminalization of Black people, specifically looking at things that happened after slavery, like Black codes, in which Black people would be arrested for crimes like loitering, and then convict leasing systems, which also emerged after slavery, in which people were not legally enslaved, but private individuals could lease people who had been in prison as a result of some of these Black codes, and their labor would be to benefit a private individual. So that's kind of the first piece, but I think what I want to highlight before I pass it off to Marlon is looking at the subhuman and the primitive labels that Black people were given, which this justified the bondage and commodification of Black people, and the life of Black people didn't matter, but the value, the economic value of their lives. And the second piece I want to underscore as we're talking about kind of the early criminalization of Black bodies was the labeling of Black people as dangerous or as threats, which our system of policing emerged to police Black bodies and to protect white lives. So Marlon, if you could elaborate a little bit more on the relationship today between America's history of slavery and how it has shaped policing.
Thank you.
For that segue, and thanks. I meant to say this in the beginning, but I always say thank you for allowing me to be in your space anytime in front of a panel of folks, a group of folks. So we can look at the present now and go backwards. I think that there's no time like the present, and but I mean like really like digital present, and in terms of the commodification of bodies, but also of the devaluing of bodies. So. We're familiar with many. Many of us are familiar with taking a lot of attention in the news with the president and the NFL and the current protests against police violence. That's what this whole thing is about: police violence. But I want to sort of like one of the tweets that one of the things that the president said is that, you know, I wish one of these NFL owners would tell one of these SOBs, son of a bitches that who are kneeling, that, you know, get off the field. And my sort of analysis of it is that it's very much of a dog whistle sort of thing, because the majority of people in the NFL are people of color. But it's a matter of that NFL owners are now sort of saying, well, we pay you to do a certain thing, and because we pay you to do a certain thing, that is all you are worth to us. You're not allowed to have an opinion about anything, right? So that's kind of like, we see it now, and I had a conversation earlier today about how if we're living in a moment of history right now where we can literally see things happening now, and for many of us who may wonder, well, how did this happen? How did we allow police to do this sort of violence to folks back in the 60s and the 30s and the early 1900s and late 1800s? Well, we allowed it now. Just wanted to sort of like give that sort of context for it, and how we can always use capital, money, as a reason why these things should be allowed. So, you know, policing in this country sort of evolved from slave catchers, right? Policing is primarily about property and protecting property. And of course, people who were, well, weren't people, people enslaved Africans were a commodity. So, you know, slave catchers were the, you know, original sort of what we evolved, what policing evolved from in this country, as protecting property, Black bodies. And then that evolved into the 1900s as, you know, policing spread throughout the rest of the country, or institutional policing spread throughout the country, particularly like here in New York City, et cetera, where like the earliest sort of incidents of police violence that ended up in some sort of uprising, you know, one of the things in Harlem in 1935 and Harlem in 1943, because of rumored police violence against Black folks, Black young folks, unarmed Black folks in Harlem, there were uprisings. Some people like to call them riots. Back in the 1930s. And then we can go forward into Watts in 1965 and, you know, Baltimore and Newark, et cetera, back in the late 60s. And the reason why I'm sort of like giving that timeline and that stream of history is that this conversation about police violence is not a new conversation that we're having. And don't, by no means is it new. In fact, if you, you know, I've just,
so before we get into the present and how, it's okay, before we get into how policing has developed to what we see it as today, I want to pass it over to our Brazilian guests, because I think it's really key to look at how the U.S. and Brazil have very similar histories of slavery. But what's very distinctive about Brazil is, one, Brazil is the country with the largest black population outside of the continent of Africa. And it also has is the country with the largest, second largest black population in the world outside of Nigeria. So I just really want us here in the U.S. to understand that racial context, but also to understand that Brazil was the last country in the Western world to end slavery. And they had, I want to say, four times as many slaves as any other country on the West. So they have a very unique and similar history. And I want to pass it over to them to kind of highlight for us how that history of slavery and the military dictatorship has shaped policing in Brazil.
Então, vou começar.
So let me start.
Eu venho de uma cidade chamada Salvador, Bahia.
I come from a city called Salvador, is the capital of the state of Bahia, northeast of Brazil.
Salvador foi a primeira capital do Brasil e é a maior cidade negra fora da África.
Salvador was the first capital of Brazil and is the largest black population city outside of Africa.
Próximo ao final da escravidão, o Brasil foi o último país a abolir a escravidão.
So after slavery, actually, you know, around the time of slavery, Brazil was the last country to abolish slavery.
O que nós poderíamos chamar de os setores financeiros brasileiros, nós costumamos chamar de as oligarquias. Eram os barões do café, eram os exportadores de escravos, eram os militares, eram quem comandava a vida econômica daquele período ainda da província ou do império.
So during the empire, or what we call the province, during those days, there were oligarchies or economic powers that really had the control of the economy in Brazil, which were the big coffee plantation owners, the ones who exported slaves, and also the military.
Pouco antes da abolição da escravatura, o Brasil, ou as oligarquias brasileiras, começaram a pensar qual seria o papel do negro nessa nova situação de relação de trabalho.
Right before the abolishment of slavery, these oligarchies started to think what would be the best position of functioning for slaves or for the slaves within the job market after they were abolished. Mm-hmm.
Então, naquele período onde a mão de obra não seria mais escrava, eles tomaram uma decisão. Iriam importar da Europa toda a mão de obra branca para começar um processo eugenista no Brasil.
The decision after slavery would be to bring white Europeans as labor to Brazil, so that would be a white population coming to Brazil for so that the population would be the population in Brazil, so that it would dilute, so to speak, the black population.
Isso aconteceu em 1888. E naquele período, toda a força militar era uma força militar privada, vinculada aos senhores donos de escravo. Dois anos depois...
So that was in 1888, and security, which was law enforcement at that time, was a private law enforcement, and it was hired only to protect the owners of slaves.
Dois anos depois, o Brasil instituiu a República e transformou em estatal toda a força de repressão. Um pouco para responder à dinâmica daqueles soldados privados que haviam ficado ociosos e um pouco para responder a uma série de legislações que se iriam criar na República.
So there was a new republic, and that was 2 years later. Those security guards, they became owned. They were owned then by the state or hired by the state so that they wouldn't just be idle. They would have a job, and that's when law enforcement was institutionalized.
E para concluir esse raciocínio, nesse período instituíram leis como a criminalização da vadiagem, ou seja, a criminalização daqueles que não tinham trabalho. No entanto, eles tinham acabado de importar toda a mão de obra branca da Europa.
That period, what happened is that they started to criminalize actions such as loitering. So basically, if someone was just found not doing anything, not working anything, they could be incarcerated. But thinking that there was no work because they started to import labor, white labor from Europe.
E a criminalização de tudo aquilo que dizia respeito à cultura africana. A criminalização do samba, a criminalização do candomblé, a criminalização de uma série de outros aspectos que diziam respeito à cultura africana. De alguma forma...
Anything that had to do with African culture started to become criminalized, such as samba, candomblé, and other aspects of Black culture started to be criminalized.
De alguma forma, isso foi muito presente. Por exemplo, a necessidade dos terreiros de candomblé se registrarem na polícia só foi extinta em 1978, ou seja, praticamente alcançou a década de 80 do século passado.
And up until almost the 80s, actually 1978, any candomblé gathering had to be registered with the police. So until almost the 80s, any kind of black gathering place had to be registered with the police.
E dois elementos no século 20 são fundamentais para concluir esse processo de criminalização contra a cultura e o povo negro. Um foi o primeiro congresso de 1938 que institui o combate ao uso, ao armazenamento e ao tráfico da maconha.
1938
em
Salvador. There were two elements on the or aspects on the 20th century that were very important when it comes to criminalizing black culture. And one of them was the decision by the Congress to criminalize in 1938 the use of cannabis.
Esse processo de criminalização se conclui quando é instituído a Lei de Crimes Hediondos no Brasil. É uma tipificação específica que fala que a pessoa presa sobre o argumento de um crime hediondo, ele não pode ser solto por fiança.
Another aspect of criminalizing blacks in Brazil is the creation of the law of heinous crimes. Basically, a person who is in jail and they commit these crimes, they cannot post bail and leave prison.
Para concluir, isto acontece porque a criminalização do uso de drogas no Brasil, ela não visa o produto. Ninguém faz guerra contra um pé de maconha, um pé de ópio. Não se atira contra um pé de maconha, se atira contra pessoas. E...
So criminalizing drugs in Brazil, such as marijuana, opium, is not really war against the product, because you don't shoot the product, you shoot persons, people.
E a transformar a criminalização do o crime de uso de drogas em um crime hediondo tende a responder à ineficácia do funcionamento da polícia brasileira. A polícia...
When you make drug-related crime into a heinous crime, what you're doing is you're showing the inefficacy of the law enforcement in Brazil.
Mas eu acho que eu vou deixar isso para um próximo ponto, senão eu vou me estender demais.
But, you know, I don't want to speak too much because we don't have that much time, so that will be for another opportunity.
Mm-hmm. All right, so on that note, can you elaborate more on the two types of policing that exist in Brazil today, and specifically tell us what the role is and how it functions on a daily basis? And please do highlight for our audience how policing is different in Black communities in Brazil versus the white communities.
Uh-huh. Boa tarde mais uma vez. Boa noite, né? Primeiro é preciso a gente dizer que a população negra, desde quando chegou nesse continente, ela não chega numa condição de ser humano. Ela chega na condição de mercadoria, de animalidade, né, e de um produto que poderia ser explorado até o seu esgotamento máximo. Né?
Um momento. So, good evening. The first I would like to say, which is very important to mention, is that the black population initially, when it came to our continent, it came as a commodity. It came as a product. And something that was animalized and something to be explored to its maximum life.
Mm-hmm. Durante a primeira metade do século XIX, quando foram instituídas as primeiras prisões no Brasil, as prisões elas vinham com o argumento de humanizar a penalidade quando a pessoa cometia um crime, deixando para trás os tratamentos cruéis e desumanos, com exceção das pessoas escravizadas, que poderiam continuar sendo submetida a esses tratamentos cruéis.
So in the first half of the 19th century, prisons in general, they decided to change their approach and they became more humanized, so to speak. So basically the treatment of people who committed crimes would be more human, less brutal, mm-hmm. with the exception of the treatment of black people in those days, mm-hmm. or slaves, or former slaves in those days.
Já naquele momento, período em que já havia uma parte significativa da população negra liberta, não escravizada, ela era o principal perfil a ocupar as cadeias públicas.
Since at that time, most majority of black population, the black population in Brazil were already free, or they were not slaves anymore. They were the ones who mostly populated prisons in those days.
Uh-huh. Então você tinha ao mesmo tempo a população negra escravizada e a população liberta que tinha o seu comportamento regulado e na medida em que cometia alguns atos como era, por exemplo, era proibido que uma pessoa negra estudasse. Então, se uma pessoa negra era pega estudando, isso já era considerado um crime.
So basically we had a part of the population was still enslaved, and then the ones who were free, they had their behavior regulated, and certain behaviors were considered against the law, such as a black person was forbidden, could not go to school or study. So if anybody was caught studying, they were arrested.
Mm-hmm. Just wanna, before we continue on the historical connection, I just want to underscore the question of the types of policing that exist in Brazil today. Specifically, I know there is like a military police and there's a civil police. So Wagner, can you explain to us how that policing functions in black communities in Brazil?
Então, é um pouco retomando aquele raciocínio que falava sobre o funcionamento dos crimes hediondos e do funcionamento das duas polícias.
So going back to what I was talking about how heinous crimes were treated in that time and the dual or two policies to do with them.
No Brasil existem
No Brasil existem dois modelos de polícia, uma polícia militar e uma polícia civil.
Ah, so in Brazil we have two polices. One we call the military police, the other one we call the civil police.
No entanto, o funcionamento da polícia civil em termos de funcionamento ou de eficiência das investigações é muito baixo. Vide o número de que somente 6% dos homicídios no Brasil são resolvidos por investigação.
So the civil police is mostly responsible for investigations. And so we can see that their performance is really low. Only 6% of homicides in Brazil are investigated by them.
Isso significa que antes de transformar o tráfico de drogas em crime hediondo, a polícia militar, que é responsável pela repressão e pelo policiamento nas ruas, prendia o indivíduo, mas a polícia civil não dava conta de investigar e transformar aquele inquérito num processo onde aquela pessoa pudesse ficar detida.
Since the military police is in charge of repression, they are on the streets and they are arresting, let's say, people who are committing drug crimes or infractions, the civil police did not have the funds or the opportunity or the means to investigate them so that they could go through the due process and be charged or...
No entanto, transformar o crime de tráfico de drogas em um crime hediondo nos fez chegar a alguns números que eu considero absurdos. No Brasil, 52% da população carcerária nunca foi julgada, foi presa e está detida sem qualquer investigação.
Making drug-related crimes into heinous crimes is a problem because 52% of the population who is incarcerated in Brazil is incarcerated and has not gone to trial.
Em alguns estados, esse dado chega a 82%, ou seja, 8 em cada 10 pessoas presas, não estou falando em uma cidade, estou falando em estados inteiros do Brasil, nunca foi julgada.
And in some states, and I'm talking about states, I'm not talking about just cities, in some states, 82% or 8 out of 10 persons are incarcerated without having gone through any trials whatsoever.
Uhum. Eu queria complementar, porque assim, o estado do Ceará é um dos estados que mais de 80%, né, da população encarcerada não foi julgada.
I would like to add to it because in my state, which is the state of Ceará in northeast of Brazil, more than 80% of the incarcerated population has not gone through trial.
E ao falar isso, a gente poderia também olhar para o perfil das pessoas que são encarceradas no Brasil. A maioria é negra.
So if we consider most of the incarcerated population in Brazil, what are they? Most of them are black.
Chegando a 60%.
Up to 60%.
Nós temos a maioria jovem.
Most of them are young.
Que é mais de 60%.
More than 60%.
A maioria tem baixa escolaridade. 53% tem o ensino fundamental incompleto.
Low education, 63% have not completed the fundamental or basic schooling.
E a gente fazendo recorte de gênero, as mulheres, né, 80% delas são mães.
And also when we think of gender, 80% of women who are incarcerated have children. Uh-huh.
São jovens, são mães e elas foram presas, acusadas de tráfico de drogas.
And they are incarcerated because they were charged with drug dealing.
E esse número chega a cerca de 70% e é bem contraditório porque a maioria dos traficantes são homens.
and it's 60%, which is a contradiction in itself, because most of drug trafficking defendants are men.
Então, enquanto você tem 25% de homens que são presos por conta do tráfico, você tem quase 70% de mulheres que são presas por conta do tráfico.
So, you know, it's interesting because we have 25% women who are arrested due to trafficking, and almost 70%.
25% men.
25% men, thank you, and who are arrested, and almost 70% women. Thank you very much.
E a maioria dela foi presa com menos de 100 gramas de drogas.
And most of the women are arrested with less than 100 grams of drugs.
Uhum. E esse fato das mulheres estarem na periferia do comando do tráfico, determina o maior aprisionamento delas.
And the fact that the women are into, as I say, in the outskirts of trafficking command, determines their incarceration.
Nos últimos 15 anos, o aumento do aprisionamento dos homens foi em torno de 220% e das mulheres 700%.
In the last 15 years, the increase of incarceration for men has been 220%, and the increase of incarceration of women has gone up to 700%.
So I just want to make the connection here. So I appreciate you, Sena, highlighting the relationship between policing and mass incarceration. As we know, this is a continuum that often starts with police and the discretion that police officers have to decide who goes to jail and who gets charged. But then our criminal justice system, it's just another pipeline, not just from, you know, who gets to get bail, but who gets sentenced, how long they get sentenced, and then how individuals are able to get back on their feet upon completing their time. So I want to pass it over to Marlon to kind of highlight for the U.S. what is that connection between our policing system and mass incarceration?
Well, thank you. So policing is like directly connected to mass incarceration. Obviously, police have the ability to take away people's freedom, take away liberty, and put people in prison. The correlation between the quote-unquote war on drugs from the 70s and moving over into the 90s and tipping off in the 2000s was, as my colleague mentioned, they weren't. Let me take it back a little bit. There is currently a public health approach to addressing drugs in this country now, right? Particularly the opioid epidemic in this country. There's a public health approach to it, as it should be, right? But however, back in the late 60s, early 70s, when opioids was a problem in this country and eventually moved on to crack cocaine in the late 80s, I mean, in the mid 80s into the 90s, it was not looked at as a public health approach. It was looked at as a criminal justice problem. So with that, what came along with that was an expansion in the prison boom. People in mass became, you know, in mass were taken out of communities by police and put inside jails and prisons. And that was the skyrocket of the prison boom that we, and the creation of the term mass incarceration. Ironically also, the time when war on drugs, when Nixon was the first person sort of bringing up to mention it, Reagan was the one to really implement it. But when Nixon, President Nixon, first brought that into the public conversation, it was literally also at the height of civil unrest in black communities. When there was a huge amount of black nationalism as well as activism in communities, a la, you know, civil rights leaders, et cetera. So I'm sort of like kind of putting that bridge together between the quelling of black voices in terms of seeking liberation and a criminal justice approach to a public health problem that resulted in what we have now is mass incarceration, which just coincides with what folks are saying in Brazil. It's kind of like, you know, policymakers have been sharing notes for a very long time.
So I think you make a great point, Marlon, on the different ways that drug use and drug criminalization is being treated. You know, specifically, if we look at the heroin epidemic, that was a major problem, like in Baltimore and in New York City. But now it's being treated as a public health issue. So we see a difference in the way our criminal justice system treats Black bodies when they are dealing with addiction versus white communities. What I want us to highlight now, and you can elaborate more on this, is how is policing different in these communities? We see how our drug enforcement has changed, but how is our policing changed or stayed the same?
Is this for me?
For you, and then we'll pass it to
Priscilla. Technically, policing has become, quote unquote, more professionalized. After several commissions, federal commissions in the 60s, it became more professionalized. However, the way policing actually interacts with people in particular communities, I can tell you personally right now, and it's even up to like a month ago, police interact with people of color, particularly in different communities, different. So I always give this example. So I'm from Brooklyn. I currently live in Bed-Stuy. If you just go a couple miles, west, to what's called like Bowram Hill or Brooklyn Heights, if you're riding a bicycle, maybe 20 minutes. It is a completely different outlook in terms of policing. You see it. You visibly see how policing interacts and how you don't see police in these communities, which speaks to the fact that police aren't necessarily the thing that creates safer communities. Because these folks don't have police in their communities as much as we do in Bed-Stuy, Crown Heights, or Brownsville. In terms of what policing looks like in different communities, there is a term, and you know, I also have a criminal justice degree and spend a bunch of time inside, but you know, there's something called selective policing. Selective policing, and it's literally implemented differently. It's implemented in particular in communities of color differently, where once again, there is a feel that we need to police these people more than we need to police certain other people.
And I would just want to add in there, Jennifer, please jump in. How do you all think in the U.S. gentrification is changing the way that policing happens? Because gentrification is changing the racial and economic dynamics of our communities, and that is changing policing. How would you describe that?
Well, one of the things we've seen, I mean, you've already given the history, so the reason why we have police in this country is to protect white people from everyone else. And so when white people move into different communities, then the policing is done differently. So issues that might have been ignored when the victims were Black people are now suddenly a lot more noticed by the police and by the community. I have done this work for over a decade, and police will always say, well, we just respond to the calls that we receive. The problem is that the calls that they're receiving are coming from primarily white communities who are calling the police on people that they think don't belong in their neighborhoods. So you see, as gentrification expands, you see a lot more of, the civility kinds of complaints, littering and graffiti and vehicle prowl, issues like that. And that's where the police then focus their attention instead of on the violent offenses that are happening in Black communities. And if you look, I haven't done a whole nationwide study, but I would guess that if you looked in any major city in the United States, the closure rate, and certainly conviction rate for violent crimes that are committed in Black communities is far lower than those in white communities. Somehow, police detectives become much more capable when the person that is complaining is a white person. So I mean, it's directly connected, and it's directly, what everyone's talking about. It is directly connected to our history of race in this country.
Wagner and Sana, can either of you elaborate on how policing happens in Black communities in Brazil versus the white communities?
Parece não, né? Não existe nenhuma regra para para a polícia fazer uma abordagem policial numa comunidade da periferia das grandes cidades.
So in big cities, on poor communities, there are no real rules for how the police should act in those communities.
E há cada vez mais aumentam os números das vítimas da ação policial, né, no combate à guerra, no combate às drogas, na guerra contra o crime. Muitas vítimas têm caído e essa bala é certeira. É a juventude negra.
There are more and more victims of these police fights against war and against crime, and it's a certain death for the black population in these situations, which is increasing.
E para justificar essa ação, muitas vezes são forjados a cena de um crime, atribuído um revólver para um jovem ou uma droga, e o que a gente chama de auto de resistência. É como se a polícia matou aquele jovem porque ele atacou, e na defesa ele acabou matando essa juventude, né, cotidianamente.
On a daily basis, we see the police trampling with evidence in crime scenes, and sometimes it will put something like a gun or drugs into a crime scene so that they have a pretext or a reason to incarcerate. And more and more we see also what they are claiming are killing self-defense. So basically they usually kill youth, black youth, and they say they had to do it to protect or to defend themselves.
E queria só para complementar assim também que a abordagem é mais violenta quanto mais você tem um estereótipo, né? Você tem fenótipos negros, né?
E so I would like to say, just to add, that it's their approach is more brutal for anyone who is stereotypically or phenotypically black.
Mas também algum comportamento do tipo tem uma tatuagem no corpo. Se você é branco e você é rico, isso é um estilo de vida. Na periferia, entre as populações pobres, ter uma tatuagem ou várias tatuagens significa vagabundagem na nossa língua, né?
So, you know, and I would like to point out that there's also a differentiation when it comes to police and the way they treat people is if you're white and upper middle class or rich and you have tattoos around your body, a bunch of them, you know, it's called just a lifestyle. And but if you have the same tattoos around your body and you're poor and live in a poor community, that is you're considered that you're loitering or you're not doing anything with your life.
So I think that context is really helpful for us to kind of put side by side policing in Brazil and policing in the U.S. I guess the next thing that will be helpful to think about is, you know, when these killings and these terrible cases of police brutality happen, there's an outrage to it. And in 2014, that was a particularly big year for the U.S. It came after the acquittal of George Zimmerman and a series of non-indictments, and then all these traumatizing videos of police violence, but particularly the murders of Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and Eric Garner really just struck a serious nerve in the American public, and we saw a lot of outrage, and that was kind of the birth of the Black Lives Matter movement. I would be curious to know, for Brazil, you know, was there a particular moment that sparked your movement?
Antes dessa relação, eu queria trazer alguns dados para a gente entender algumas diferenças na relação do que a população negra no Brasil e nos Estados Unidos.
Before we get into that, I would like to bring up some information just to help you understand the difference between black issues in Brazil and in the US.
Se eu não estiver equivocado, no censo de vocês de 2005, 12,8% da população norte-americana é negra.
If I'm not mistaken, according to your census of 2005, 20.8% of the U.S. 12, yeah, I put 12, thank you. 12.8% of the U.S. population is black.
E vocês têm uma representatividade melhor que no Brasil, porque já tiveram um presidente, um promotor de justiça. Nós temos uma população na escala nacional de 53% da população negra. No meu estado, ou melhor, na minha cidade, mais de 80% da população é negra.
Even though you have only 12.8%, black population here, you have better representation. You had a black president, and also you had important black prosecutors. And in my country, we have Brazil. We have 53% black population. My city, actually, not my state, my city is comprised of more than 80%. Of blacks.
Esses dados somados aos números de guerra que o Brasil tem de violência. O anuário de 2015 diz que no Brasil houve mais de 6 mil assassinatos. Esses números nós costumamos dizer que são números de guerra. Perdão. 60 mil assassinatos.
60 mil.
Esses números nós dizemos que são números de guerra porque o Brasil é o país que, onde se mais mata e onde se mais morrem policiais, mas esses números são, por exemplo, superiores ao número de mortes por armas de fogo na Síria, que está em guerra declarada.
We have in 20 according to 2015 data, there were 60,000 homicides in Brazil. We call these war numbers. They're war numbers because
Brazil's a place where there are more homicides and where also police officers die most. Actually, our numbers when it comes to deaths and homicides are higher than the deaths caused in the Syrian war.
E embora tivéssemos um caso emblemático recentemente, a prisão do Rafael Braga, é preciso citar que no Brasil, chacinas, mortes coletivas de pessoas, é algo comum. Podemos começar a citar isso historicamente, onde todos os anos vai ter acontecido ao menos uma chacina de grande porte. O ano passado, ou melhor, no intervalo de menos de um ano, na Bahia, nós tivemos a chacina do Cabula, onde 12 jovens negros foram mortos pela polícia. Todos os policiais envolvidos foram absorvidos sumariamente.
One emblematic case is the recent case of Rafael Braga, but I would like to say also...
Your microphone. It's not on.
A recent case was the case of Rafael Braga, and I would like to remind you also that we have, historically, we've had massacres by perpetrated by the police, large massacres. As a matter of fact, less than a year ago, we had one in the state of Bahia, we called the Capula Massacre, in which 12 young black men were killed by the police. And I would like to say that none of the police officers involved in that killing were charged or convicted.
So,
thank you.
Did you want to?
Yeah, I want to sort of like, not necessarily push back, I don't think it's the right term, but I think the comment about, you know, we have better representation and because we have the president, we had President Obama. While I admire President Obama, there's no question about that, but I think black and brown folks have been harmed so much in this country that when we see something that looks a little good, we think it is actually good. And so kind of like going back to the Malcolm X quote where like you got a knife in my back, you pull out halfway, am I going to be happy that you pulled out halfway? I need you to take the knife all the way out my back. And I think that while President Obama has done has done, it's probably the best president this empire has ever had. He's still a part of this empire. And during that time, we still had Ayanna Stanley Gurley. We had Trayvon. We had Mike Brown. We had, you know, I can like name the list. We had all these things here, and we still had police officers held not held accountable for that. I think the cloak to believe that because we had a black man in representation in the highest executive office in this country allows us to sort of like believe that things have been better. And now, because he's just been out of office a couple of months, and look where we're at right now. If things were tremendously better, it wouldn't take just a couple of months to undo that, right? I just want to put that there. And I think that the other part, just to bookend this, is that the levels of police massacres in this country towards people of color is not spoken up enough. I mean, we had police bomb an area in Philadelphia, the MOVE movement in the late 70s. We had Tulsa, Oklahoma. We had the Easter Day massacre in New Orleans in the late 1800s. Like the context of police violence and police massacres happen in this country, and it's happened in mass. And I don't think we give enough. That's not spoken about enough. So it looks like. It looks like it's okay. Similar to like when we see what happened over the past 8 years, and I applaud what he has done in those past 8 years, it looks like things went away where it's still very much there.
Thank you for highlighting that. I want to pass it over to Jennifer, because I think when we talk about the president and what kind of expectations we have, especially of a black president, to do something about the violence that we see particularly happening to black people. Jennifer, can you highlight what the challenges are to holding police accountable, whether that be hiring, firing, or actually prosecuting an officer for abusive conduct?
I mean, the biggest challenge to holding police accountable in this country is that the majority don't want to hold the police accountable. And that all of the efforts are kind of designed around trying to convince white people, I mean, to be honest, that the officer should be held accountable. And the laws are designed to prevent that. There are use of force laws that allow police to claim self-defense for shooting people, even when you and I would have been prosecuted for murder. There are protections around all kinds of, you know, that's my training says that this is what I'm supposed to do, and so then everybody says, okay, fine, that was how this officer was trained, so no one gets held accountable. Even when police officers are criminally prosecuted, juries almost never convict. Sometimes they do, but it's very rare. And it's rare because we have been indoctrinated in this country since most of us were little kids, that when something goes wrong, you go to the police, and the police are the good guys, and the police are supposed to protect you. And if this officer was just doing his job, you know, it's too bad that somebody died, but we can't really fault him for that. He's doing a dangerous job. I hate to be so just stark, but that's the reality of it. I think that the efforts, particularly during the Obama administration, were to look at ways not to use the criminal system to hold police accountable, because clearly that wasn't working. And so instead, the Department of Justice started really using its power to do investigations of police departments across the country. And the most investigations of any Department of Justice since the law was enacted that gave them that power to do that. It was not a perfect tool. It was very labor intensive and very expensive, but it did start to highlight the really significant structural problems with police departments and policing. In Baltimore, for example, and there was a direct line in the findings letter in the Baltimore investigation to redlining and to intentional segregation. There's a Chicago finding that, of course, who knows what's going to happen in Chicago, but that investigation was really designed. I was talking to one of the attorneys who was working on that investigation, and they took it to the activists, and the activists said, well, duh. I mean, we knew this. This is not news. But that's not the audience. These investigations are designed to show the majority population that what people of color have been saying for centuries is true. And that was really a lot of the value of these Department of Justice investigations. Of course, now we don't have that tool anymore. And folks are having to regroup and figure out how to continue on with the advocacy and the activism without having the federal government even somewhat on their side. So.
And Wagner, can you tell us in Brazil, what are the challenges to holding police accountable?
Eu acho que uma das primeiras questões é a tortura, que é uma prática institucionalizada e que ocorre cotidianamente nas prisões durante o aprisionamento e quando a pessoa já está na delegacia ou presídio.
One of the first issues that I would like to mention is torture, which is institutionalized on prisons and also when the person comes to the police department also when it passes through the police department.
Nessa tortura, preciso destacar que quando a pessoa é uma mulher, faz parte dessa tortura a violência sexual.
And I would like to say that this torture, I would like to stress that this torture involves sexual violence against women when the person incarcerated is a woman.
Outro grande desafio está relacionado ao poder judiciário, que quer resolver tudo com o encarceramento. E é preciso dizer que a população negra, ela tem uma condenação duplamente, às vezes triplamente maior do que as pessoas não negras.
And I would like to also criticize the judiciary that sees incarceration as a solution to a lot of problems, and also that the number of black women that are incarcerated is threefold compared to the non-black population.
Before we continue on in incarceration, can we just highlight for the audience what specifically are the challenges to holding police accountable in Brazil? Why are police in Brazil able to get away with abusive conduct?
Eu queria só dar outro destaque, e aí eu passo para Wagner, que é as condições da prisão no Brasil.
I would like to stress, I'm going to give the word to Wagner, about the conditions of prisons in Brazil.
Hoje pela manhã, quando a gente estava na conferência Smart on Crime, vimos algumas lutas e algumas falas de situações que no Brasil a gente nem sonha.
We saw during our conference in Smart on Crime, we saw a few images shown to us of situations that we do not even dream about in Brazil.
Porque a situação é muito degradante e desumana. O ano passado teve caso lá no Ceará de visita às unidades prisionais em que o Conselho Nacional disse que se tivesse que transformar aquele presídio num zoológico, ele interditaria e nenhum animal poderia viver ali dentro, quanto mais um ser humano.
And I would like to talk about the degrading and non-human conditions of the prisons in Brazil. There was a visit by the National Council to prisons in Brazil, and they said that those prisons would be forbidden for animals in a zoo to live there, so and humans are living there.
E nessa lógica do encarceramento, mais e mais prisões são justificadas a serem construídas.
And with this rationale, the incarceration rationale to find solutions to problems, they're building more and more prisons.
So, e nós estamos mais na luta pela abolição das prisões.
And we're fighting more and more as activists to end the so many prisons.
So I think solutions is key when we talk about the problems that exist in our criminal justice system, whether it be prison conditions or policing. So I guess we're about to wrap it up so we can open it up for questions, but I want to ask each panelist, what do you see as a vision for like how policing should happen? If you are using your imagination right now, how should policing take place in the most productive way?
Well, I want to say, like, when hearing all of us speak here, you understand why we say Black Lives Matter? Like, you get it? Like, even beyond an American context? So I think in terms of policing, I think I'm a little bit more to the fringe of the conversation that I don't see training and reformation of the police as an institution of policing as the actual answer. That has been tried, and history will tell you that. There have been several commissions, even up to the president's President Obama's 21st Century Commission on Policing, where there have been several commissions over the years about how we can make policing better. And I'm saying that policing can be better. There's no question about that. But I think the problem, we have to identify what the problem is, and it's the fact that we rely on police for everything, but particularly in specific spaces and particular communities, right? And you can't, but the things that police do to people in communities of color, they're not trained to do. They did not train to give that chokehold that they gave to Eric Garner. They were told not to do that. They did that. They were told not to shoot the brother who was killed the other day. They was trained not to shoot him in the back. They shot him in the back, right? It's not a matter of training. It's a matter of that we have to be thinking more creatively about what does it take to create community efficacy, community empowerment. Because I also ask everyone in here to close their eyes at the moment and think about the safest community, greatest day, and what have you. And who would you see in that vision? You wouldn't see law enforcement. But we've been conditioned, even though our vision doesn't see it, when we open our eyes, we think, well, we need police here. And I think that's not the reality of what it is. As you mentioned in the beginning, I can't remember the young lady on the end. Jennifer. But we've been conditioned to see policing as the end all be all, but only for particular communities, and particularly communities of color. And I'll just give one little example and to pass it off. I'm looking at it right now on my computer, but for bicycle summonses, just something as simple as bicycle summonses, and you look at communities in Brooklyn like Park Slope or communities in Staten Island, Greenpoint, communities where there are more white people that live there. And you compare it to a amount of summons that were given to communities in the Bronx and in South Jamaica and Bed-Stuy, East New York, Brownsville. It's almost double the amount of summonses that was given to in these communities, which are predominantly communities of color. Are we saying that people of communities of color ride a bike more? Of course not. That's absolutely not true, especially now with gentrification. But when I, but it's literally it's similar to the Second Amendment. That's a whole other day and another topic. But it's literally really rethinking the role of policing, period.
No Brasil, a gente tem duas situações. Uma que vai ser difícil mudar enquanto a gente não mudar o racismo estrutural. Há exemplo de que Rafael Braga foi condenado à prisão por portar pinho-sol. Pinho-sol não é tipificado, mas ele é um homem negro, estava numa situação pública, isso é sabido e notório, no entanto, ele foi preso e condenado por um juiz branco. Um outro caso...
Peraí. So we have two situations in Brazil, I would say I'm going to talk first about one case, but if we don't change structural racism, we're not going to go too far. A good example is of Rafael Braga, which I was talking about. He was was carrying pine saw, cleaning product, you know. But just because he is black, and he was charged by a white judge, so that's one situation. And the other situation is.
Nós temos um outro caso que é o de Jonathan Matos. onde ele foi morto no Rio de Janeiro, portando um saco de pipoca. A polícia confundiu seu saco de pipoca com drogas e o executou.
Jonathan Matos, he was killed by the police. He was just carrying a bag of popcorn. And police thought that popcorn somehow were drugs. And he was executed by the police.
O que quero dizer com isso? Que para o sujeito negro, não importa se a substância é lícita ou ilícita, se ele estava com uma arma ou com uma mera pipoca na mão. Ele é o sujeito de um modelo de segurança pública que vem de um período que no Brasil é muito caro, que é a ditadura militar.
If a person is black and doesn't matter if he or she is carrying something that's legal or illegal, what matters really in Brazil is the model of law enforcement, and that model comes from our military dictatorship.
Existe uma semelhança comum entre o escravismo, a ditadura militar e a guerra às drogas. É que todos eles têm um inimigo comum, e esse inimigo é interno, é o sujeito negro no Brasil.
And there's a similarity, or something in common between slavery, the military dictatorship in Brazil, and the war against drugs. And the approach is we have an internal enemy, and that enemy is the black person in Brazil.
All right, we're going to pass it over to Sena. What do you think are possible solutions to policing in Brazil?
Acho que inicialmente a organização popular, a organização dos diversos movimentos.
So first of all, I think that people should get organized and we should have different resistance movements.
A denúncia das violações de direitos.
And also the denunciations of reports of human rights violations is important.
E para mim uma coisa que é fundamental, essa luta tem que contar com a participação direta dos principais sujeitos afetados.
And also what's key to me is that this fight has to include the direct participation or involvement of the human beings who were affected by that.
E a própria pressão popular, né? A pressão popular na polícia, no Estado, nas políticas públicas, na política de segurança, na política de drogas.
And also civil society, or pressure by civil society when it comes to law enforcement, to policies, and policies against drugs, etc.
All right, I'm going to end with Jennifer. What do you think, if you use your imagination, would be a way to think about better policing in the U.S.?
So many things, and I agree with what my colleagues have said. I particularly agree with Marlon that we ask the police to do too much. They are not trained, and they are not equipped, and they're not capable of doing so much of what we ask them to do. They're not mental health professionals. They are not family caregivers. I mean, maybe they are in their homes, but why do we expect that they will be able to take care of our children better than we take care of our own children? So we need to take away those tasks from them and fund the social services that can actually do those tasks, do them safely and do them appropriately for the communities that they're working with. And we have too many crimes. We just have too many crimes. There are too many. I mean, the idea that you've got all these people getting these citations for bicycling, if you kind of do a cost-benefit analysis or even just look at what, I mean, everybody has a different definition of public safety, but really, is it making Brooklyn any safer to have all of those bicycle citations out there? I seriously doubt it. But there are groups across the country that are really looking at some of those offenses. Loitering was mentioned, jaywalking, littering, those things that right now allow police to interact with people in a discretionary way, and those discretionary interactions end up with somebody dead, not very often, but can. And because of that, we need to take away those things from their toolbox. There's no reason why someone jaywalking should end up face down on the ground because they refuse to not jaywalk in front of a police officer. So, yes, let's take things away from the police. That's my solution.
Eu queria pedir desculpa, mas eu seria extremamente negligente com o que está acontecendo no Brasil se eu não citasse duas situações.
I would like to apologize, but I would be extremely negligent if I didn't mention two situations at the moment that are going on in Brazil.
Uma é uma iniciativa popular, tanto vindo dos movimentos como da sociedade civil, chamada Agenda Nacional pelo Desencarceramento.
One is a popular movement that is coming from civil society and also organizations that is called Agenda Against Incarceration.
Que elencou 10 pontos que estão sendo construídos conjuntamente, tanto pela sociedade civil, do ponto de vista das ONGs, quanto pelos movimentos, que apontam questões estruturais rumo ao desencarceramento.
10 pontos, você falou? So there are 10 different points that organizations, as well as the civil society, are addressing in order to reduce or to end, in some cases, incarceration.
E no que diz respeito à polícia, tem duas iniciativas que devem ser respaldadas. Uma é a dos comitês populares pela desmilitarização da polícia militar.
And as per law enforcement, there are also two measures that are very important that are taking place right now. One of them is the demilitarizing of police.
E a segunda é um debate que vem acontecendo desde dentro da polícia, que tem tido diversos nucleamentos a depender do Estado brasileiro, em alguns estados conhecidos como policiais antifascismo.
And second is a discussion that has been going on in Brazil on certain states que são policiais antifascistas. It's police officers against fascism.
E comitês formados por próprios policiais que compõem um pedido de desmilitarização da polícia.
And there are commissions within law enforcement that are fighting in favor of demilitarizing law enforcement.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Can we get a round of applause for our panel? And now we have a couple of minutes to open it up for Q&A. If you can, just line up here at the mic and we can take your questions.
Okay, so my question is about sort of the idea of I think, Peterson, you might have been touching on this a little bit, but like the abolition of police rather than like trying to, you know, do reform or create change sort of using the system. What are sort of the pros and cons you see of sort of instead of pursuing the systemic change that we've been trying to do for so long without seeing a lot of meaningful change or impact? What are the pros and cons of the idea of abolition of police in as a whole, and do you see that as a viable option?
That's to everybody.
I'll take a shot at it really quick. I think there's a quote from a mentor passed away, Eddie Ellis, who used to say there are no prison problems, there are only community problems. And by that, he didn't mean that there weren't problems specific to prison, but that all the problems that we have in the prisons are microcosms of what's happening in the communities. And one of the problems that we have in communities is, I think when we think about policing, there needs to be a both and. There are folks who are doing reform, and that's fine. We need folks doing that work. It's not an either or yet. But what I'm saying is that if in the reform space, we should be working towards the reduction of police as a force in our communities as a whole. If you think about the numbers, just in New York City, it's about 35,000 or more police officers in the city. That's more than many countries' standing armies. And when the majority of police officers are concentrated in specific communities. We need to be thinking about what it would, as I said earlier, any reform initiative should be with the viewpoint and the sight of how can we eliminate the use for law enforcement in this space. There's inherently, I think history tells, inherently there is, I'm not supposed to get short, right? But inherently there's something that's attached to the weapon and the power that police officers have. They can literally take your life or your liberty. And I think in the human psyche, the more encounters that there are with police, we'll continue to have these what we call mistakes that we've been having over and over again. So I do think that abolition is super important. I don't think that happens tomorrow. That's mayhem. That's chaos. But I think we need to be thinking about like what can we do, as I said before, to build up communities so they're not so reliant upon law enforcement.
Is this on? I apologize in advance. My question is going to be kind of long-winded, but I want to...
Okay, wait. So before you do that, I'm going to have to ask you to keep your question as brief as possible so that we can give the panel opportunity to respond.
I'll make it brief, but I wanted to highlight something for our Brazilian guest. When they were talking about representation, our system of policing and incarceration, it's a carceral system that's very capital-driven, no matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican, and both Obama, the past president, even our current Democratic candidate, or our last Democratic candidate, Hillary, were both very capitalist driven. And I wanted to know, in Brazil, when you look at mass incarceration and policing, is there definitely a profit aspect to that?
Great question.
Sem dúvida. Tem precedente dentro da legislação brasileira que é... Teoricamente, no Brasil, qualquer pessoa, para trabalhar com o vínculo mínimo de formalidade, ele tem um salário específico. Dentro do sistema prisional, é a única possibilidade que o capital tem de explorar a mão de obra, pagando menos do que se é estabelecido como mínimo para a dignidade humana.
Então, as a matter of fact, absolutely. In Brazil, the incarceration system is very good for profit because there's exploitation of labor in Brazil. So basic in prisons. So basically, what they earn is less than anybody could survive.
Sem contar que temos.
Thank you.
Sem contar que temos situações de privatização dos presídios, em que existem contratos feitos com empresas que vão administrar o presídio e com o poder público, que se aquele presídio não receber um número X de presidiários ao longo de X anos, o poder público vai pagar para aquela administração, mesmo se não tiver os presos. Ou seja, o contrato é feito para que cada vez mais se continue encarcerando, para que aquela empresa tenha lucro. Ou seja,
There's also a system of privatizing prisons. So basically, the public or the government keeps supporting or giving money to prisons. So even if they don't have, you know, even if they get to a point where they don't have enough people in prisons, but that in a way encourages prisons to exist and to get more and more people incarcerated.
Encarcerar provoca duplo lucro.
There is a dual profit that comes from incarceration.
Se lucra quando se encarcera, porque o privado vai ganhar.
The private system is going to make money when you incarcerate someone, so that's one way.
E com o sujeito encarcerado se lucra explorando a mão de obra que está abaixo de qualquer linha do mercado.
And also there's exploitation of labor with the incarceration of human beings because it's very cheap labor, much lower than anywhere in the market.
Cuidado.
All right, any other questions? Okay. Oh, go ahead.
I was just I was wondering in Brazil what the racial
representation. Where is the other kid?
I was wondering in Brazil what the racial representation looks like in law enforcement, because I know that's a huge issue here. Like, the police forces will be extremely white despite being in a very black community. So I was wondering what that looks like in Brazil.
Okay.
Eu vou só fazer um pequeno comentário sobre ainda a resposta anterior.
I have a comment about the previous answer.
Sobre a privatização das penitenciárias, dizer que o nosso país, o Brasil, adora copiar os Estados Unidos.
About privatizing and prisons, I would like to say that Brazil loves to emulate the United States.
E assim como esse país inspirou o Brasil a projetar sua guerra contra as drogas.
And as this country has inspired Brazil to have a increase its war against drugs.
Nesse momento também é crescente a privatização das penitenciárias.
At this time, more and more prisons are being privatized.
E como
as well.
Wagner já falou, é um negócio bem lucrativo.
Because as Wagner just mentioned, it's a very profitable business.
E em relação à sua pergunta, a maioria dos policiais é negra.
And regarding your question, most police officers in Brazil are black.
E institucionalmente, embora haja na pergunta anterior foi acho que foi você que falou da falta de preparação, né, de formação, de capacitação da polícia.
I think you mentioned before you were sitting to my right. Sorry. You talked about. I'm sorry, falou sobre o quê? O que você falou agora? Repete com você.
Ah, sim, sobre a capacitação, a formação de policiais.
You're talking about training of police officers.
No Brasil, eu diria que existe muita capacitação e que essa capacitação tem um viés racista.
I would say that police officers are well trained in Brazil, quote unquote, but they are racially trained.
Então, nas descrições, né, do material didático que policiais são formados, eles são orientados a identificar que quanto mais escura a cor da pele, é lá onde ele vai identificar criminosos ou possíveis criminosos.
On training textbooks, it's on those books, they train police officers that the darker the skin color, the more they should work on identifying criminals.
Então, ao abordar um grupo de pessoas negras ou estar num território predominantemente negro, a polícia já não pergunta, não faz pergunta, não quer saber o que está acontecendo, já chega atirando, né? E em nome disso, várias pessoas inocentes têm sido atingidas e, inclusive, morrido.
So in these gatherings where they're mostly black people or mostly black neighborhoods, the training is no questions asked. So police officers just get to these neighborhoods or these gatherings and they just start shooting. And with that, a lot of people die, a lot of innocent lives are lost.
Resumindo, não é falta de capacitação.
In sum, there's nothing, absolutely nothing to do with low training at all.
Thank you. One more question. Yes.
um,
Thank you for a very excellent and very informative panel. In the United States, we have something called the Police Code of Silence, wherein if there's wrongdoing or brutality or misconduct by police, that the other police rally around them and don't reveal the illegal conduct that's there. Is there something similar to that in Brazil?
O Brasil tem algumas situações bem específicas.
You have very specific situations in Brazil.
Algumas coisas que acontecem aqui que facilitam, por exemplo, a identificação do policial num caso de ilegalidade, lá não acontece.
So things that happen here that make it easier for a police officer who commits an illegal act to be identified, that is not the same in Brazil.
Com frequência, no Brasil nós vemos vídeos a partir de câmeras que são portadas pelos próprios policiais.
In Brazil, many times we see video footage of body cameras that are carried by police officers.
Do ponto de vista técnico, eu acho essa uma alternativa muito interessante e não tão cara de implementar para toda a corporação no Brasil.
And I think technologically it's easy to implement and it's not that costly to implement for law enforcement in Brazil.
No entanto, não existe um interesse na implementação. Há exemplo de dois casos. Na chacina do Cabula, que foi cometida por policiais, eles chegaram a desligar o GPS das viaturas para que o comando não tivesse noção de onde estivessem enquanto aquela operação estivesse sendo realizada.
I'll give you example of the Cabula massacre, in which the police car GPSs were turned off. So while they were engaged in a massacre, they would not be found.
Na primeira saída de Rafael Braga da prisão, ele é abordado por policiais, que também, mesmo com o GPS ligado, o juiz negou que pudesse se apurado por onde aqueles policiais tivessem passado. Porque se apurasse o GPS, estaria entrando em contradição o discurso do policial e o que de fato aconteceu de verdade.
The first time Rafael Braga was freed from incarceration, the GPS, actually the police officer's GPS was on, but still the judge decided in favor of them. And
o juiz falou do GPS?
A defesa de Rafael Braga fez pedido para que se apurasse o GPS.
Rafael Braga's attorneys asked proof or evidence to be gathered about the police GPS.
E o juiz negou.
Okay. And the judge denied to have any evidence during trial of the GPS.
Ou seja, mais uma vez demonstra que não é a falta da possibilidade do elemento técnico de controle das polícias, e sim uma certeza do Estado brasileiro de que essa polícia ela não deve ser controlada pela sociedade.
So the issue here is not technology. We have great good technology for law enforcement, but it's a mentality in Brazil that the police or law enforcement should not be controlled by civil society.
Existe discurso comum na polícia brasileira que os seus controles internos, que nós chamamos de as corregedorias da polícia brasileira, o discurso é que elas funcionam. No entanto, nenhum policial anda identificado. Então, você não consegue localizar para a corregedoria que policial está cometendo tal ato. Se você pega qualquer vídeo de repressão de ato público no Brasil, os policiais não têm qualquer identificação. Embora na farda exista espaço específico para que isso seja colocado e na legislação traga a obrigatoriedade da identificação.
So, yes, there are ombudsmen within within law enforcement, and there are internal controls of law enforcement, but police officers, they are required to wear their names or their IDs, and they never do. And the law requires that they carry their names, that they show their names, their ID, but they never do it with their uniform.
Well, thank you so much for the presentation. You've made a great connection historically between Brazil and the U.S., but my question is a little bit more forward-looking. Both in Brazil and in the U.S., there is a rising tide politically towards the right. So what do you see the impact of that in the work that you do?
Sir, do you want me to do it in Portuguese?
Que tem uma tendência cada vez mais para ir.
Eu posso perguntar em português.
Okay, so the question in English was that. No Brasil quanto nos Estados Unidos, está crescendo muito um viés político para a direita, né? Então, vocês fizeram uma conexão excelente no aspecto histórico. Como é que fica agora olhando para frente? Como é que isso vai impactar o seu trabalho? How much does it impact in the U.S. and in Brazil as well? Thank you.
I just want to be clear. You said how much does the tide towards the right, yeah, inter politically, how does it affect?
How do you think it's going to affect the work that you do? How is it going to affect policing? Because in Brazil, there's a growing popular support for the right. You mentioned dictatorship. There is actual popular support in some factions of society towards the new
I mean, the rise of populism on the right is something that comes and goes in this country. You think back in the early 80s, after Carter, there was a Reagan, there was a rise towards populism towards the right, and then we went sort of the middle. So things come with ebbs. It comes and it goes. What we see is happening, at least in this country, even with the current attorney general, is a rollback of policies that the previous attorney general and the previous administration had implemented. But not only a rollback, it's a neglect, even a more overt neglect of issues of police violence and racial injustices. So what we're seeing now is literally that you can't even critique it, literally. Like, you can't critique it, as we see now when I open up with the NFL. Like, you can't critique it without seeming as unpatriotic, un-American, etc. That has happened before, but I'm just saying, like, you can't even critique it right now. I think at this point in time, what needs to be done is that folks need to be doubling down on a critique, on a resistance towards these policies. But also, here's a moment where the right, the fringe on the right, is now getting a platform. Right, here's that moment, the fringe rising on the platform. I think those of us who are on the other side need to be brave enough to be able to embolden those on the fringes, because that's one of the things, if there's a critique on the previous president, is that he's a centrist, and he shied away from emboldening and from giving empowering folks with someone on the fringes of it. He sort of separated, you can do that there, but don't ask me to say it. But we see that on the right, they're able to do it, and they do it with confidence, and they do it with strategy. And I think that for those of us, we need to be using these moments, as there's a moment of heightened awareness of injustices, to be emboldened in some of these more radical ideas in terms of what justice looks like for Black and brown people.
Pedi desculpa porque eu não ouvi a apresentação toda. Tive ruído, mas se eu for repetitiva, vocês me avisam.
Please let me know if I am being redundant, because there was a problem with my headphones, so I didn't hear part of what was just said by Marlon.
Acho que tem duas questões que a gente precisa tocar. É que durante os governos ditos progressistas ou governos democráticos populares no Brasil e na América Latina, o uso da força esteve sempre presente e crescente. O que a gente tem assistido de militarização no Rio de Janeiro, ele é pensado e executado ainda durante os governos democráticos populares.
So two aspects important aspects of popular democratic regimes in Latin America are that there's always the force, there's militarization of those movements. So even today, we see within Brazilian democracy, we see the use of force, and we see more of a militarizing of law enforcement in Brazil.
No caso dos governos democráticos populares, o uso da força tem diretamente a ver com o que a companheira Jennifer colocou. O modelo de gentrificação, ou na verdade, a força necessária que foi utilizada para blindar determinadas cidades, como o Rio de Janeiro, para o acontecimento da Copa do Mundo e das Olimpíadas, que sem o uso da força militar seria impossível receber delegações de fora naqueles territórios sem apresentar para essas delegações um dito nível de segurança desejável padrão FIFA ou padrão Olimpíadas.
As our friend Jennifer was mentioning about gentrification, I would like to say that the popular democratic governments are the ones that have approaches such as protecting Brazil, Rio de Janeiro, actually, during the World Cup and Olympics, that they had to militarize the streets in order to have these this level of protection and security so that the games could go on in Brazil.
Even left-leaning governments, even the left has had militarized approaches. Now we're on the right today, right?
Dentre esses legados, a presidenta Dilma assinou um acordo que era uma legislação necessária para receber as Olimpíadas. A lei antiterrorismo.
So Dilma, President Rousseff, had signed agreements in order to be able to receive people during the Games and the Olympics. One of them was the anti-terrorism bill or law.
Sobre protestos de defensores dos direitos humanos e de todos os movimentos sociais, porque esta legislação hoje possibilita a criminalização dos protestos e movimentos sociais.
And that criminalizes today any protests or any movements in favor of human rights today, any protests.
No atual governo, que nós consideramos um governo golpista e ilegítimo,
With our current government, which we consider that was formed through a coup d'état, and
essa prerrogativa foi utilizada, inclusive, para reprimir os protestos que reclamavam do impeachment que a presidenta sofreu. Então, ela acaba sofrendo, provando do seu próprio veneno.
So this bill that was passed into a law was actually used also to stop movements against her impeachment. So in other words, the former president ended up tasting its own venom, so to speak.
E para finalizar, no Brasil hoje, nós estamos vivendo um momento muito sério. Ainda em junho deste ano, em protestos contra o governo ilegítimo, o governo mais uma vez chamou à tona um decreto chamado Decreto de Garantia da Lei da Ordem, que colocou o exército na rua contra a população que protestava no mesmo dia que o decreto foi promulgado. Ou seja,
And last but not least, I would like to say that in June there was a decree that was passed, and it's illegitimate, and it's called the Law and Order Guaranteed Decree that puts the army on the streets and against the population. E põe o exército nas ruas contra a população. E que mais?
Já concluo, porque faz pouca diferença. Isso, no Brasil, nós estamos tendo o exército sendo colocado contra a própria população com uma frequência inimaginável, o que tem despertado em setores militares um debate de volta de intervenção militar no Brasil para garantir a dita lei e ordem. Nós estamos, nesse momento, com diversos setores da população reivindicando a volta da intervenção militar no Brasil.
So we have the army against the population on the streets in Brazil, and the name of this law and order, reestablishing this quote-unquote law and order. And we have actually sectors of the civil society, of the population, in favor of bringing back the militaries to the streets.
O que é muito contraditório ao ponto de vista de que um dos, ou talvez o segundo em hierarquia das Forças Armadas, foi a público, em entrevista, dizer que se o judiciário não tivesse capacidade de conter o grau de corrupção e de insegurança que o Brasil estava vivendo, que o exército faria pelas forças militares.
Current corruption is not contained, and current issues are not contained, that the military would come and take over if it is not contained by the law enforcement.
Eu gostaria de trazer alguns destaques em relação ao avanço das forças conservadoras.
Microphone. I would like to stress the increase of conservatives, conservative forces in Brazil.
Queria destacar primeiro a criminalização para as mulheres que fazem o aborto.
I would like to talk first about criminalizing abortion of women.
Okay. So before we get off topic, I just want to redirect us back to the question or pass it over to Jennifer for a response.
To the rise in.
Yeah, the rise of.
Of the right. I think that it is a frightening time because I believe that there are people who are feeling even more empowered than they were before to use the police and to encourage police abuse. But if there's a potential ray of sunshine in all of this, it's that people are really, like me, scared and realizing that we can't just sit back and say, oh yeah, those fools, those whatever, that there really has to be. And I've seen a lot more organizing, a lot more willingness for people to stand up. So I think that's encouraging. I feel like things are gonna get a lot worse before they get better. And I'm just very, very, encouraged by the hard work of the activists that I get to interact with throughout the country, because they're there, they're in their cities, they're on the ground. These folks are on the ground in Brazil, and it is not easy work, and they're willing to do it even though they're putting themselves at risk. And that's what we have to do. We can't be complacent and assume that somebody else is going to come in and save us. Folks have to stand up, and they got to stand together. And if there's a way to do that, then I have some hope. It'll take some years, but I have some hope that we'll be able to right this ship a little bit.
All right. I want to thank everyone for attending this event, and we look forward to keeping you posted on our next steps.
Very important issue to raise right here. So I would like to continue.
Eu estava começando a falar das forças políticas dentro do Congresso Nacional, forças fundamentalistas, religiosas.
Going to talk about fundamentalists and religious forces within our Congress right now.
Que têm se esforçado para derrubar as duas formas que o aborto é legalizado, que é quando a mulher sofre ameaça de morte e quando ela tem uma gravidez de uma violência sexual.
There are forces against passing by Congress, which hasn't passed yet, but bills to allow abortion if either a woman is threatened, or her life is threatened, or if she's pregnant due to rape.
Uhum. Então há um esforço, inclusive, de derrubar essas duas possibilidades e de intensificar a criminalização de quem se quer ajudar uma mulher a praticar um aborto.
And so there is these possible bills, there are forces against them, and also forces to criminalize even persons who may help or give support to a woman to have abortion.
Esse contexto também, ele tem favorecido um avanço das forças que lutam pela redução da maioridade penal.
And also, this also has to do, or is at the same level of the ones who are in favor of reducing the age for to be
criminal responsibility.
They want to.
E temos também uma ampliação das forças armadas. No Brasil tem a chamada guarda municipal, que deveria zelar pelo bom convívio, pela ordem, o cuidado com o patrimônio, e essas guardas têm se armado e têm agido de forma muito violenta cada vez mais.
And city law enforcement, who is usually just there to keep order and peace, they're being more and they carry more and more guns and they're involved in more and more brutality, and they shouldn't, because they're just there to keep peace and order in towns.
E por fim, eu queria falar da criminalização dos movimentos sociais e da perseguição às pessoas que lutam pelos direitos humanos.
And also I would like to talk about criminalizing social movements and criminalizing people who fight for human rights.
Temos sido constrangidos e ameaçados, principalmente quando fazemos enfrentamento e denúncias dos agentes de segurança pública.
And we have been threatened, especially when we report anything against law enforcement.
É isso.
And that's it.
I just want to say thank you to our panelists, and thank you. We have other Brazilians who are here with us on the trip, and I'm sure they'd be interested in talk to you further. I also want to say Jasmine had to run to catch a train, so I'm sorry she ran off the panel. But so Hala, can you stand up right here? She has been behind the scenes organizing this, so thank you so much for Hala to organizing, and of course our lovely translators and interpreters. Thank you. Please enjoy the reception.